Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week we go back to the 1980s with the Romanian black comedy Tales of the Golden Age. Zan Brooks talks to Palme d'Or-winning director Cristi Mungiu about the funny side of life under a dictator. And the nominations for the British Independent Film Awards were announced this week. Frontrunners include Andrea Arnold's Fish Tank and Duncan Jones's Moon, both films we've championed here on Film Weekly. I'll be talking to actor Jason Isaacs about this year's nominations and the state of British independent cinema. Peter Bradshaw joins me to run through the week's releases, including An Education, scripted by Nick Hornby and starring Carey Mulligan, and 50 Cent and Brenda Blethyn, together at last, with Danny Dyer. It's Dead Man Running. Yes, this is it. It's Film Weekly.
What the fuck's your problem?
Your terrible dancing's my problem.
Look, Mia, just don't start.
You can tell, Kaylee, since when did you have such ugly friends?
Talk about ugly, you skanky little pirate.
The unmistakable Essex sound of Andrea Arnold's Fish Tank there, which picked up a stonking 8 nominations for this year's BIFFAs, the British Independent Film Awards. Other nods have gone to Moon by Duncan Jones, Bright Star by Jane Campion, and In the Loop by Armando Iannucci. To discuss the strength of this year's nominations and more, I caught up with a man asked to make the official nominations announcement, British actor Jason Isaacs, famous for his role as Lucius Malfoy in Harry Potter films, and to our US listeners for his role in HBO's Brotherhood, and soon to be seen in Paul Greengrass's much-anticipated Iraq film Green Zone. We're down at the BIFFA nominations launch, and the man launching them is Jason Isaacs. Welcome to the podcast.
It's an honour. I've been long waiting my invitation.
I had to say, you introduced all this. Do you find yourself like as kind of an emblem for British independent film in some way?
No, I'm in the Harry Potter series. I'd say it's very far from being a British independent film. No, I'm lucky enough to be on the advisory committee. I was on the jury one year, and I just found it exciting to watch hundreds of films, you know, most of which will never reach the screens, although they do end up on DVDs and you know, in stores near you and on telly. But there's amazing storytelling talent out there, and they tell stories that are not made for 15-year-olds and don't have people who can fly or walk through walls in them.
The British Independent Film Awards, they've come quite a long way, actually, and the list this year is quite impressive. They're kind of good films that are going to find themselves not just nominated at the BIFFAs, probably at BAFTAs and maybe even beyond.
Well, it is odd that world has overlapped, particularly since when I take a proper objective look at the film industry, the big studios have all let go their satellite companies. They all, for a while, latched onto independent film and created these smaller companies that essentially were making independent films. They've now closed most of those down. And yet, maybe it's an anomaly, but this year, a lot of the films that are nominated have been seen in multiplexes and will probably be nominated for Oscars. Oscars and BAFTAs and stuff. Of course, that's why the Oscars have expanded the category to try and have 10 Best Picture nominees, because they've been embarrassed in previous years that no studio fares got through.
Jace, you've been a producer yourself. You brought good to the screen recently. You brought good. You brought general good.
Thanks very much.
You brought a film called Good to the screen recently, yeah, in which you starred. It's difficult, you said in your speech, to get a film made these days. The crisis, economic crisis, everything is transpiring against people trying to make films. How is the scene out there?
Well, I think it's a bit of a case of the boy that cried wolf. For a long time, people have said, and it's true, how impossible it is and how difficult it is to raise money and to get closing money and to get distribution and marketing and all this stuff. However, now out there, it's barren. It's a desert, and people are, frightened of putting food in their fridge, let alone investing in film, which is quite a high-risk investment. So it's slightly embarrassing having made all this fuss before, because now you look back at the periods of time when it was difficult to get funding, and it's a golden age by comparison. I think that it might be difficult to come up with a crop of films of such quality next year. In fact, I know numbers of the filmmakers who are on the list this year for nominees for Best Film, Best Director, and they've said to me personally they didn't think they could make those films in today's climate.
And what about actors as well? Most actors I've met around at the London Film Festival, they're sort of, I say, darling, are you working? And they kind of go, oh, blimey, I wish.
It's not a great time, actually, for anybody in the business. I mean, a bit like in The Godfather, when they say every few years the families have to, there's a big shakeout. I think there's a cull going on of people who make films and want to be in front of and behind the camera. And it's unfortunate, because the kinds of people in this room here today and the kinds of films I had to watch to be on this in this advisory panel are the kinds of things I like to watch, and there will unquestionably be less of them. But even if you look at big studio fare, there's less and less. They've slashed their production from 30 or 40 films a year to 12, and most of those involve superheroes.
But you're all right, you're working.
I'm doing Harry Potter, which is fantastic, and God bless it, for many, many reasons. And I was in an American television series until it was cancelled at Christmas. And so, like everybody else at Leavesden, I will be emerging back into the abyss of freelance work early next year, and I dread to see what I'll find there.
And finally, when are we going to see Green Zone? I saw Paul Greengrass on the red carpet the other night. He said it's very soon, it's finished. It's coming out?
It is coming out early next year. I've seen it. I'm one of the privileged few. And I can tell you this, I think it's fantastic.
You're good in it.
I'm not saying it because I'm not in it that much, frankly.
Right.
So I don't feel like it's boasting. I don't know. Frankly, I can't bear to watch myself in anything. But Matt is amazing. And Paul
Damon.
Matt Damon, sorry. Matt, my mate. Although he is a lovely bloke, very matey. But I think Paul Greengrass, who has previously really spanned two worlds, the big, exciting, edgy-seat blockbuster and the kind of socially and politically realistic highbrow film, has now married them both just perfectly.
Well, I can't wait. I think he's a great director. And he's carries that British independent film spirit as well, so that's why I introduced him here.
Well, I have to say hats off to Paul and to Matt Damon, who use the leverage that you get from being two of the most successful filmmakers in the world, making that giant Bourne franchise and going, we want to make a film about something that actually is important in our lives, but we're going to make it entertaining as well. And they pulled it off.
Thanks. Best of luck with the end of Harry Potter, and thanks for introducing the Biffers. Thanks for coming on the podcast too.
Thank you.
For a full list of the nominations, go to biffa.org.uk. The winners will be announced at a glittering ceremony on December the 6th, and of course, Film Weekly will be there. To help me review some of this week's releases, I'm joined now by Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Welcome on an all-too-rare visit to the pod.
Thank you.
Delightful to have you. The Biffers, Peter, are these a good thing? Is there enough to go round?
Yes, anything which increases our prize euphoria, I think, is a good thing. Just another kind of cocaine blast of prize delirium in our rattled bloodstream is good, as far as I'm concerned. I don't mind.
There are good things in there. Fish Tank and In the Loop, I recall receiving a highly starred ratings from you.
I absolutely adore these films. Looking down the list, these are films which I mean, it's hardly the only films that I sort of. There's hardly anything I dislike. I mean, there's everything is sort of good, and anything which gives us all a bit of a big up, British film industry a big up, it's all right with me.
Absolutely,
great.
Absolutely. I mean, Education, Fish Tank, In the Loop, Moon, which I liked very much.
Moon, very good.
And
yes.
your friend of mine, Peter Strickland from Catalina Varga.
Mr. Peter Strickland, yes.
And his actress, Hilda Peter. Who's got a British newcomer, best promising newcomer, even though she's from Romania or Hungary. I don't know where she's from.
I mean, it's... well, you know, there's you know, there might be a few, you know, harsh words from Peter Strickland sort of behind his... under his breath, in a way, at the idea of the British, of him getting a British award when the British industry so resolutely did not assist him. You know, he went abroad to do this and never got so much as a brass farthing from the UK Film Council. No, he got plenty of kopecks from other people. You know, the Hungarians and the Romanians, as far as I understand, seem to have, you know...
Embraced him.
But it's strange because it's a British film in the sense that he's British... But that's it, really. It's by any yardstick, it's not a British film.
Absolutely.
In some ways, it's a kind of a repudiation of the whole British semi kind of subsidised scene that we kind of all have semi signed up to.
In a sense, his is the most independent kind of venture out there.
It really is independent, truly independent, in a way that you know, BBC Films Project, they're not independent.
I know.
He created Catalina Varga from the sweat of his brow. I mean, he rolled that boulder up the hill to create that movie. I mean, he took it out of his intestines, basically. I think he should win for his sheer dedication.
Absolutely. Coming from Reading, it's a long way to the Biffers. But Peter, let's move on to the films that are out this week.
Yes.
We'll look at An Education, Dead Man Running, and Star Suckers.
Yes.
Let's turn to An Education first. It has got nominated for Biffers. It played at the London Film Festival, and it is now on general release. It stars Kerry Mulligan alongside Emma Thompson and Peter Sarsgaard as a debonair Jewish lover, and it is written by Nick Hornby.
How far advanced are these ridiculous plans? Have you set a date? Have you decided on a church?
We won't be getting married in a church. David's Jewish.
Jewish? He's a Jew. You are aware, I take it, that the Jews killed our Lord.
And you're aware, I suppose, that our Lord was Jewish.
Kerry Mulligan and Emma Thompson are there. I thought that was a nice juxtaposition because you've got Kerry, who's kind of blossoming this role. It's kind of a breakthrough happening before our very eyes.
Yep.
And her teacher in the film is Olivia Williams, who always thinks is a nice British actress. And yes. then you've got Emma Thompson, who's a sort of headmistress, sort of the generations of what happens to British actresses.
Yes. I mean, I think Emma Thompson is very good in it. I mean, she gives she uncorks what she's now in her kind of late phase, like Henry James and Beethoven. She's having a late phase, a late phase of absolutely kind of poised and slightly camp, eyebrow-raising cameos.
She's turned into Maggie Smith.
Sort of becoming a Maggie Smith. I think she needs a big role like Maggie Smith, but it won't be long before she's, as it were, playing a kind of mother superior of sadistic
tendencies. Sister Act. Sister Act the musical awaits.
I thoroughly enjoyed An Education. It's a fascinating film because it's stranger than fiction. You couldn't, as it were, make it up because it looks a bit like a kind of kitchen sink drama from the Taste of Honey and Billy Liar kind of stable, in a way. And yet it's not going according to the script, the traditional script. It's, well, however middle class the people making the films are, it's always about a working class girl who gets into trouble. Or, in this case, she's middle class and she doesn't get into trouble. That's interesting.
She has to be like the character in Alfie who's kind of ruined, isn't she?
Yes, yes. She's not ruined because she stayed, her middle class kind of career biography has stayed on track. And of course, it's all about getting into Oxbridge, which I think is this brilliantly kind of uncool, non-street cred thing.
So how is your dramatic fulcrum?
Yes, whether she might not get a place at Oxford. And that's so brilliant. I love that. My only quarrel, I think, with Nick Hornby's adaptation, which is very sure-footed, is that he slightly fudges what I think is a brilliantly embarrassing thing in the original, is that in the original, her poor old dad has to go crawling back to this headmistress to beg for her to be allowed to come back and sit her Oxbridge exams. That's where her glamorous adventures in Sex and Paris have led her, to her father humiliating herself at this private
feet-day
school.
I did feel that in the film there were some slightly sort of different registers going on. I think Alfred Molina was sort of playing one character as the dad.
Yeah.
Carey Mulligan was doing this bright, kind of witty, kind of 16-year-old. Then Peter Sarsgaard was doing... Why is Peter Sarsgaard in it? I don't get it. Why he's an American, but do it, because I think that's such a good part for a British actor, a Jew from 1961 Twicken, a very specific accent, a very specific person who's got kind of delusions of grandeur going up west and that kind of Rachman kind of property speculation. I thought it was a bit odd, actually. His casting kind of struck me as he's good, but it grew on me.
I think to get an American actor in it is important for funding and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but is he that famous? I mean, he's not.
Well, he's not that famous, no. But nevertheless, a US star, you never know, there are wheels within wheels. Who knows what he brings to the party?
Yeah, it gets him to Sundance, doesn't it?
Yeah, at development stage, who knows what his agent in the in-law relationship, which extends invisibly behind all these meetings, who knows? But For good or ill, his performance did grow on me. The problem, as you say, is that in the original, there is an obvious age disparity between a 16-year-old and a 39-year-old. Their ages look closer in their film, so you've lost that. But by accidental design, he does look very creepy.
Yeah, absolutely.
He specialises in slightly delusional characters.
Sweaty top lips.
Yes, and the fact that he's doing this English accent, which, in the way of all Hollywood actors doing an English accent, is slightly too slow. It creates this sort of creepiness, and I think sort of by accent more than design, it did work. And I think there is something kind of creepy about it.
It's interesting you mentioned the age disparity in Lynn's book, and in this film, you sort of forget that there might be a touch of paedophilia going on here.
You forget it, I think, until you see that awful moment in the nasty, seedy hotel room in London Airport where he asks to see her breasts, and you realise that, tilt this story a little bit, and it's a story of sex abuse. It's not a romantic story at all, or these aren't star-crossed lovers. He's a perv.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's a perv.
And you feel he's done this before.
Oh,
and
yes.
will do it again.
Yes, yes.
An Education treads lightly over numerous genres, but more firmly in the traditional British gangster genre is Dead Man Running, starring Tamer Hassan and Danny Dyer as two unlikely underworld lads. 50 Cent has come from America. He's in London for 24 hours. He wants his money back. Tamer Hassan has just got 24 hours to get 100 grand, or his mum gets it.
You got 24 hours to get back all my money. No, I'll kill you. You's a dead man running. What do you want?
Everything's far from
all right, now move. You took a load of Figo. What are you, completely insane? And
we're going to raise 100 grand in 24 hours.
His mum, of course, is played by Brenda Blethyn, who is being held to ransom by Phil Davis. This is just British gangster meets kitchen sink. It's all there, Peter, darling.
It is all there. I don't know quite how to say this. I didn't think it was bad.
It isn't, is it?
It isn't bad, and I think I have now got to start one of the most painful processes of intellectual revisionism since the Second World War. I don't think Danny Dyer is bad either.
Neither do I.
I think he's not bad at all. For some reason, he has appeared in a string of films that I hate. But he is, I think, a very distinctive, very relaxed, utterly assured actor who really is his own man. He doesn't look like everybody else. He doesn't look like a character from EastEnders. He really is absolutely his own man, and he's not bad. He was in Severance, and I remember him being quite funny in Severance.
He was funny in Severance.
And
in The Business. He was funny with Tamer Hassan. He was the kind of the boy Frankie who goes
to
Bayer.
It was all right. Yeah, that, again, that's not a film I love, but again, he was pretty good. And he was also in The Great Ecstasy of Robert Carmichael, incidentally, always sort of playing the same role. But
there's a lot of drugs involved in Danny Dyer parts.
Yes, there always, for some reasons that I hardly care to guess at, there always is. This isn't bad, as I say, that had that weird and rather funny kind of two-hander with Phil Davis and Brenda Blethyn, as if sort of Mike Lee had been brought in as a second unit director to do that. I hate this cultural cringe to a real American star, the idea that 50 Cent comes in. He clearly is as bemused and clueless and contemptuous of everything in real life as he is in the film.
I can hardly understand a word he said.
No. The weird thing is, it's pretty good, actually.
It's a sort of
bad
underworld caper, isn't it?
It's a caper. It's knocked off from Guy Ritchie, the idea of having to get underground in 24 hours. Oh, it makes me sort of wilt.
And it hasn't got the pace of Guy Ritchie's kind of larky, I suppose, original.
The original, yes. But as I say, it's, what can I say? It's not bad, and I think there is a sense that we have been maybe a bit too snooty about certainly about Danny
There's
Dyer.
A classic Dyer scene, isn't there, when they have to get a black taxi, yes, they call them a black rat, to do a run.
Black
rat. Because you're carrying 35 grand of cocaine up the motorway. The only way to do that is in a black taxi.
Apparently,
of course, as we all know.
Yes.
And Tamos, he wants to stop and he wants to get a cappuccino because it's going to be a long night. And Danny says, you don't need that because I've got the little bag of cocaine. And he gives it to Tamos as he's driving and goes, cappuccino, bollocks. That is, that's my line of the year.
It's pure
in more
dire
ways
gold
than one.
Yes.
That's Dead Man Running. Peter, we'll move on to Star Suckers. This is a celebrity spoofer, a kind of sociology text put onto the big screen in documentary form by Chris Atkins, and it examines our addiction to celebrity.
The most successful editors of the newspapers have been former showbiz journalists, and their standards have corrupted other parts of journalism.
It ceases to matter to these big media organisations whether it's true, whether it's legal. They're not in the business of telling the truth.
And this goes right to the top. The Prime Minister's wife's baby is part of a trade with Max Clifford.
Now, Peter, I did think this was a sort of open university programme, but with kind of knobs and whistles.
Yes.
But interesting, nevertheless.
I thought, for about the first three quarters of an hour, I was thinking, what is the point of this? What are you telling us all this for? We know all this, don't we? You know, we're too obsessed with celebs. Yes, I know. He does this long thing of hoaxing the tabloids, which, incidentally, is the most pointless thing in the world. You know, you only get to hoax the real idiots, like the Star and the People. Yeah. Anything slightly further up, like the Express, well, they secretly fill meetings with the Express, but that doesn't prove anything because the Express didn't go for
it. The guy on the Express news desk sort of says, well, actually, under the 23 of the Press Complaints Commission, he kind of knows his onions. It's when they ring up the Star showbiz desk and some girl goes, yeah, that's interesting, Amy Winehouse, so we'll get back to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's hoaxing the tabloids, I think, is meaningless and smug on the whole. Rocky Ryan, that awful man, used to do it. Amanda Iannucci did a gag on the hour, I remember, over 10 years
ago. And Chris Morris has been
spoofed. I mean, in the era of Chris Morris and Max Clifford, spoofing the tabloids is meaningless. But I have to say, and I was sitting there thinking, this isn't very good. But then, quite unexpectedly, Chris Atkins pulls out a brilliant critique of Live 8. Absolutely cracking, barnstorming.
I mean, it absolutely takes the carpet
out. It apart in a way that perhaps we should have done, but I don't remember anybody doing so until now. And he rather cleverly and tactlessly says, this is how it works. So far from putting pressure on the real G8 summit, it was in fact a kind of PR event managed and encouraged by politicians in order to showcase pre-arranged conclusions with a kind of, you know, all these celeb monkeys dancing to the politician's tune. And he traces the relationship between Richard Curtis through his wife Emma Freud up to Matthew Freud. Matthew Freud is married to Elizabeth Murdoch, whose father, of course, is Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch, of course, was in those days a supporter of and a beneficiary of the Labour government. And so it all stitches together.
It's brilliant. It's a sort of last chapter as well.
It's a sort of last chapter. And suddenly he pulls out this. I would have liked to have seen it really more on that, really. But my goodness, what a cracking
piece. It sort of leads up to, because it sort of says, well, we're addicted to celebrity from a very young age. If we start watching telly at 5 years old, then we become sort of obsessed with one of being inside that telly. And that is the kind of, which, you know, I think is kind of facile and kind of it's possible and easy. But when it leads up to us all being hoodwinked by the fact that, my God, there's Live 8 is on.
Yes.
And the fact that it was on in Hyde Park at the same time as the G8, and then it went to Murrayfield at the same time they were at Gleneagles. And suddenly it's like, well, why didn't we think of this?
Why didn't we... make more of a fuss at the time, because we wanted to participate in the celeb euphoria, that kind of meaningless...
And we all covered it. I mean, all papers, from Guardian to The Sun,
yeah,
and that
we
was...
covered it, and we were, by and large, uncritical. We raised a few eyebrows.
We said, oh, what was Madonna wearing?
It was always in the sense of, well, you know, will it really do any good? But on the whole, we sort of like it. It's well-intentioned, and golly, you know, isn't this so great, blah, blah, blah. And Chris Atkinson's film is the first one I've seen to really say, no, it's a complete confidence.
Yeah, and on that level, it's up there with the sort of Alex Gibney, Taxi to the Dark Side, and the Enron Smartest Guys in the Room. It's on that level of kind
of
corporate
think
swindle.
It is. Yes, it's not necessarily financial. There may be financial, but as a kind of cultural and intellectual confidence trick, the idea that, and it is about fame, it's true, and he's right to concentrate on fame. We loved it because we thought it was brilliant that they were all famous and all together, but it actually achieved far less, was in fact more insidious than Live Aid in 1985, which of course may have been a kind of mutual masturbation session for gigantic A-listers, but it did raise money, which some of which might have been lost or misappropriated, but it did achieve something.
It's just very brief before Zan goes to meet one of the directors of the Tales of the Golden Age. This is a compendium of Romanian shorts.
It's a compendium of Romanian
like
shorts. It does
sale.
Sound awful. It's coming out presumably for the 20th anniversary of the great downfall of Nicolae and Elena Ceaușescu, that one of the most extraordinary events in all our lives. And it seeks to kind of tell little stories about people's lives of quiet desperation.
It's a rich scene that they keep mining, these Romanian filmmakers.
It is a rich scene. It is interesting because it's about black comedy. It's not just his last film, of course. Christian Mungiu's film was 4 months. It was a horrifying film about an abortionist.
4 months, 3 days, 4, 3, 2, 1.
4, 3, 2, 1, yes, exactly. It's about, allegedly about, urban myths of all the things that people allegedly got up to, all the indignities and absurdities that they underwent just to survive. And the absurdities were part of staying sane, like classic anti-Soviet comedy. You laugh as an alternative to crying. And it really did work very well. The quality of the short films is uniformly, I think, pretty high. The best one is about having to slaughter a dead pig, but doing so silently so that nobody else will know you've got all this pork, basically. I suspect it might have been influenced by Alan Bennett's A Private Function. but I didn't mind that. That's great. I was thinking, well, are these real urban myths, or have they made up the urban myths? And I think, well, no, you know, truth is always stranger than fiction. And I bet that these weren't just urban myths. I bet they all actually happened. It's a kind of a novelty of a film. It's difficult to sell portmanteau films. I'm intrigued by little collections of short stories. Very few people do it. And when they do, it always turns out to be kind of rubbish in a way. I can't really think of many that I've liked.
They're not great ones, especially those really short ones, like the Paris I Love You and the New York
I
Love
You.
Yes,
you see, they are so awful, those ones. They're so awful. Whereas this is... It's interesting.
But these are like half an hour long as well.
Yes,
so
they're about sort of 15 minutes each. They're originally six. So he's cut it down. He's cut one of
like
the six out.
It's like a Jeffrey Archer, Quiver Full of Arrows.
Yes, as well.
What a compendium that is.
Roald Dahl's Tales of the Unexpected. It's good. It's good.
Peter Bradshaw, lovely to see you. Thank you very much for joining me. For all of Peter Bradshaw's golden reviews and much more, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Buddy, what are you doing?
Mă dore gâtul.
Ah, a tras curentul.
Că l-a îngețat.
As you heard Peter and I discussing there, Romanian cinema is on the crest of a new wave, evidenced by the release in the UK this week of the portmanteau film Tales of the Golden Age, spearheaded by Palme d'Or winning director Cristi Mungiu. Zan Brooks went to meet Mr. Mungiu and started out by asking him why so many Romanian films continue to look back on the 1980s.
Because there are so many memories, and now 20 years later people got this distance that they needed, and they can look back without, you know, the anger of the first years. But, basically, it was a time when it was huge poverty and a great famine, I would say, in the last years. So, and I was speaking today with a Romanian that lives here, and we remember that in the last years of the regime, Ceausescu got involved even in a program of establishing what is rational for people to eat. And I don't know how somehow he decided that 100 grams of meat per week would be enough. And I remember there were the communist advertising for frozen fish. Apparently they discovered that frozen fish is good for your health. And I don't know where they were catching it, but you wouldn't want to eat like frozen fish every day. And there was a shortage of power every night. It's true to say that because we were adolescents, that was kind of fun for us because it gave us the opportunity of just walking around with candles and making fun of it and stuff like this and not having to do homework. So it's a mix, you know, it's a mix of memories about how difficult it was. But at the same time, because of our age and because the responsibility was mostly for our parents, some of our memories are still good.
So do you find yourself, against the odds, feeling nostalgic for certain aspects of that time?
I find myself nostalgic as every 40 years old is nostalgic for his 20 years old. That's all. I mean, it's nothing about the system.
I think there's a line at the end of 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days where they say, we're never going to talk about this again. Is there a danger of a kind of cultural amnesia seeping in that people don't want to look back 20 years?
Well, honestly, today in Romania, when we're releasing these films, we have to fight against our own title because people really don't want to remember too much. Everybody wants to live in the present as much as possible. But I wouldn't say that making these films I was trying to serve any kind of like a social or historical or educational purpose, or not to start with. I wanted to make these stories, first of all, because they are good stories. I've been telling these stories, traveling around in festivals for years and years. And every time the reaction for these stories was so good that at some point I said, look, I need to make a film out of it at some point.
Tell me a little about these stories. They're sort of absurdist, tragicomic stories. We have the press photographers who are ordered to doctor a picture of Ceausescu. We have the family that brings home a live pig and don't want to kill it because the noise will just alert their neighbours to the fact that they have a live pig to eat. Which are your personal favourites of these stories, and are there some that you feel are truer, perhaps, than others?
We have a different understanding of the concept of urban myth that you're having here. So we are positive that these stories are true, to be honest. I'm not sure if all of them were true in the sense, in the way that you watch them in the film. But for example, the one with Ceausescu's hat, that was quite popular in the period. We understand an urban tale as a true story which was told so many times that people added up lots of details and changed it and placed it in different places in Romania and corners, but the core story was true.
Now, the film is directed by a series of different directors, but it's very hard to work out who directed which episode. So I'm not sure which one you personally directed. Why did you make that decision?
Well, since it's so difficult to know who directed why, we consider that it's irrelevant, you know. This is a film, and for me it's really very important to say that this is just one film that can be watched as a film. There's a limit about collective films that people will refer to episodes, saying that I like that episode better, or I can see that that episode was directed by I don't know whom. And that's not the point, you know, it's not a race between the episodes who gets somewhere first. And the big asset for me in Cannes was that people couldn't say who directed what. And after the first interviews and a few attempts, we decided that we're not going to speak about this at all, because it's really not important. A collective film should stay collective.
As well as in your course of traveling around festivals, you have become an ambassador for what is termed over here the Romanian New Wave of cinema. Are you aware of this Romanian New Wave? If so, why do you think this is a particularly vibrant creative time for your country? And is that, do you think, related to the fall of communism?
Well, it's difficult to say this because communism disappeared also in Bulgaria and Ukraine and in a lot of other countries. So I'm not sure it's directly connected with this. There is something happening over there in terms of cinema, that's obvious. And I would say it's the best moment in the history of the Romanian cinema. But why is this happening now and why it's happening like this, that's very difficult to say. I suppose there are a lot of things that need to happen at the same time for something like this to become visible. First of all, there was this law for cinema that gave more and more people the possibility to make their debut in cinema. Then there were the first good films which were noticed immediately by the Cannes Film Festival, which had a lot to do with this revival of the Romanian cinema. And these first films established a level that the others to come needed to match. And the level of the expectation for a Romanian film now is, you know, really very high.
Tales from the Golden Age goes on general release here on the UK from Friday the 30th of October. And that's nearly all for this week. We must just announce our competition winners from last week's show. We had three copies of the excellent soundtrack to the documentary Made in Jamaica up for grabs. I asked you which reggae legend starred in the 1972 film The Harder They Come. Of course, it was a youthful and dynamic Jimmy Cliff. We got loads of entries, but the winners are Barry Noonan, Blaze Murphy from Down Under there in Australia, and Kate Fennell, a little bit closer to home, from London, SW2. CDs are in the post on their way to you. This week, our music was from Bernard Herrmann's first ever score to Citizen Kane. The film getting a big screen re-release here in the UK this week. Is it still the best film ever made? Let us know. Film Weekly Fans is our Facebook page. You can answer to us on our blog, of course. Do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer newspaper for my trailer trash column and the best film reviews from the London Film Festival. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.